fires if there's a certain type of electrical failure in their motors. LASCO confirmed 7 reports of fires associated with motor failures in the fans. 2 house fires and a barn fire caused heavy property damage. LASCO says it will provide an adapter with fuse protection. Consumers are advised to stop using the fans until they've contacted the company and received the safety adapters. The box fans are made in the U.S. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Lawyers for Jared Loughner, the suspect in the shooting rampage in Tucson, Arizona, are asking a federal judge to reconsider an order to send him to Missouri for a psychological evaluation. Loughner has already been transferred to a facility in that state. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Healthcare Compact Alliance, working for citizen control of healthcare. Information at healthcarecompact.org.
From the earliest Sandlot baseball games to championship high school teams to the University of Illinois to Olympians and Paralympians, sports has been a major part of the city of Champaign. Those athletic achievements are as many and diverse as the competitors themselves. As we continue to celebrate the city's 150 years, we'll revisit some of the individuals and teams who've made their mark. Next time on Illinois Pioneers, 7:30 Thursday night on WILL-TV.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. After the attacks of 9/11, it seems that almost everybody was asking the same question. Why didn't the United States government recognize this threat and try to prevent the attack? And it seems that a big part of the problem here was that the United States had a number of different government agencies who may have had some piece of the puzzle here, but that nobody put it together. And the big metaphor that people use then and people still talk about is connecting the dots. What that means is that the government has access to an enormous amount of information from all sorts of resources, human, satellites. Everything that it collects gets filed away somewhere. But the big issue that people said was, the big problem people said was, well, it's not being gathered together, sifted through, so we can find the information that we're really looking for. People have suggested ways to do that, and it's something that's been discussed a good deal since 9/11. However, our guest for this morning, Shane Harris, says that this kind of effort to collect this kind of information, do analysis, try to find evidence of people organizing to attack the United States, this effort actually goes back some way before 9/11. It goes back, in fact, all the way to the 1980s. And this is the story that he tells in his book, The Watchers. The subtitle is The Rise of America's Surveillance State. The book was just published last year in hardcover by Penguin, and it now is just out also from Penguin in a paperback edition. So if you'd like to read the book, it is available. Shane Harris writes about electronic surveillance, intelligence, counterterrorism for National Journal in Washington, D.C., and he's joining us by phone. And Shane Harris, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
That's a pleasure.
Just to start off here again, I guess to use that oft-used metaphor here, the dot connection thing. That's after 9/11. That's what everybody was talking about. They said, look, the United States government has the access to, actually has possession of, an enormous amount of data and information. So the question is, can you somehow sift through all of that and look for the little in all of this, the little pieces that you really want, and get that put together?
Right. That was the big question. I mean, it sort of became apparent, I think, to everyone in the government and, you know, in the public as well, after these attacks, that, you know, some different silos of the government had different pieces of this puzzle, if you like. And the big question immediately became after, well, the first one, of course, being like, why weren't they put together, is how do we start doing this? How do we create, through technology, through new laws, through new policies, a way where we can put these dots together, not just so that we can figure out catastrophes after the fact, but that so that we can prevent them. And this whole sort of doctrine of prevention, of preemption, really started to take hold. But, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, it's something that actually stretches back far before 9/11. 9/11 was just, I think, the most obvious example of an intelligence failure on a massive scale that people had ever seen in this country.
Yeah, this I think it's a really interesting story. And after 9/11, you can take a look at the effort to collect and collate and do analysis on this kind of information. There being really two tracks, and we could talk more about this, but just to talk about it just a little bit at this point, being two tracks, one that was public and publicly discussed and fairly open, and one that was not.
Right.
And the one that was public, this thing that came to be called total information awareness, involved a character that some people knew about at that point, and to some it might have been new. But this was somebody who was a prominent figure in the Reagan administration, Admiral John Poindexter, someone who was a national security advisor to Ronald Reagan at the time of the Iran-Contra scandal. So for some people, that would be a familiar name. This is something that you started writing about in the early 2000s, not long after 9/11, because he was involved in this effort of trying to get all this data together and figure out some way that you could mine it for usable information.
That's right. He basically came back to government. Of course, he had been in during the Reagan administration, as he had to resign in the wake of the Iran-Contra scandal, and then had his own legal battles to fight as well. But he continued this sort of mission that he had been on since those days of trying to use information technology to predict national security crises. It was one of his big agenda items when he was in the White House under Reagan. And he and some business partners that he'd been working with in the private sector after 9/11 decided that they had this idea for this program that they dubbed Total Information Awareness, and that they thought that the best way to move this forward would be to try and get the government to adopt it as an official program. And so rather than take it, though, to the intelligence community, per se, where it would be run potentially in secret and behind these different layers of classification, they approached the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, a group called DARPA, which is probably most famous as having actually invented the primordial Internet. DARPA is sort of the think tank, the brain trust of the Pentagon, where a number of just really, you know, sort of disruptive, high-profile technologies that we have changed society as we know it have been developed. Stealth technology was developed there. The Internet was developed there, as I said. And the idea was to take this program, Poindexter would come back to government and run it as this DARPA program, and it would be almost, as he dubbed it, a Manhattan Project for counterterrorism. They wanted to throw lots of resources at it, the best minds, the brightest minds, and to keep it public so that they could get scientists, technologists from really all over the country, maybe who'd never worked with government before, and kind of get it out of the traditional bureaucracy of the spy agencies. And this is really, I don't think he planned at all to ever come back into government, and in fact resisted at first coming back to run it officially himself, but he and others made the determination, I think, that he was probably the most personally invested and had the most knowledge about it, and was really the only one who can do it. But had real reservations about that, given his extraordinarily controversial past. Once it became known, of course, that he was running this program and all of the associated aspects of it, things like data mining, things like potentially collecting information on individuals, this whole intelligence apparatus being set up by the former ringleader of Iran-Contra took on a very sinister tone and quickly was his undoing in that project.
What's really interesting here, and it shows that maybe it was natural that Poindexter would be the person who would be doing this, is that, and this takes us back into the 1980s, people will perhaps recall in the early 80s, there was a terrorist attack on some Marines that were stationed in Beirut in Lebanon. Almost 300 people were killed by two truck bombs. And after that happened, a lot of people were asking the very same questions that were asked after 9/11. They said, why didn't we try to – we should have been able to anticipate this and head this off. And at that time, the person who was delegated to be to look into why the dots were not connected then was John Poindexter.
That's right. he was actually he had been the deputy national security advisor for about a week when the suicide bombings in Beirut happened in October of '83. Was literally woken up from sleep by the White House Situation Room, calling his home to tell him what had happened. The president was actually out of town with the national security advisor, and so it sort of immediately in the aftermath of it fell to Poindexter as the senior person at the White House to kind of gather the troops on this. But he also, as the deputy national security advisor, was kind of the behind-the-scenes guy at the White House. He was the one who was really making the contacts with the intelligence community. He had relationships with the military. He was an admiral at the time, of course. And he was sort of the guy who just in general was trying to kind of keep the trains running in the national security apparatus, if you like. And pretty quickly, as he began to investigate what happened in Beirut, it was apparent to him and to others in the intelligence community that there was actually a tremendous amount of information that the government had been collecting about terrorism in Beirut, about threats directed at the Marines who were stationed there as part of a peacekeeping mission, even about suicide bombing and potential targets. And yet none of that information was coalesced or was fused together, and the threat was never appropriately communicated to the commanders of the troops on the ground so that they might actually take a defensive position and get ready for a potential suicide bomber. They were really practically, sitting ducks when it happened. It really came out of the blue, and because they were there on a peacekeeping mission, had not really fortified their positions there in the city. So Poindexter, I think, took it upon himself as sort of naturally being this kind of behind-the-scenes operator to say, we have to do better. We have the resources for this. We have information. We're not sharing it with each other. The CIA is not talking to the FBI. The State Department needs to be talking to the military. How can we kind of all get in the same room, if you like, literally and figuratively? And he set about, over the next few years, putting together different kinds of apparatuses to do that, both different kinds of policy committees, new kinds of technology to put in the Situation Room, which at the time was really kind of a technological backwater that had never been updated since the Johnson administration. And he sort of becomes, the conductor of this kind of great symphony for counterterrorism. Ultimately, those efforts are derailed by Iran-Contra, and the kind of energy dies when Poindexter leaves. But that was really the first time that any administration had tried to make a coordinated effort to connect the dots, to get all the different players together. And, of course, the theme just repeated on 9/11 at a much more magnified scale.
Well, and that's what's so striking about this, is when you go back and you look at the analysis after the Beirut barracks bombing there in 1983 and the kind of things that people were saying, as you said, that, in fact, within the possession of the government, there was a lot of information that was pointing towards this. And yet the problem was that it was not being shared between agencies. The communication there was bad, that it wasn't being communicated to people on the ground there in Lebanon who could have done something. And it all of the same sorts of things that people were saying after 9/11 in terms of problems. So it's what seems to be really striking is that we identified some real problems then, but somehow didn't carry that through if in 2001 we still had the same problem.
That's right. It really, it's something that you often see will happen in a big bureaucracy, particularly government, is sometimes one person will kind of become the champion of an idea and become sort of the major player and the force of energy behind that. And when that person is gone, that energy sort of dissipates. Another key part of this, that the reason of why I think the administration from the Reagan administration to the first Bush administration kind of backed away from this idea of having the White House be the central coordinator of all this intelligence, which is what Poindexter was doing, was that, of course, the Iran-Contra affair was all about the White House conducting covert intelligence operations without congressional oversight, even in defiance of Congress. So subsequent administrations and presidents really started to take this kind of hands-off approach to dealing with tough intelligence problems. And what happened was, I think, that various agencies like CIA and FBI and all these different agencies that had a stake in it sort of, took their one part of it and it kind of calcified there. And again, no one was sharing information, people weren't communicating about the problem, and so you were sort of back to where you were before the Beirut bombing. So this energy was kind of picking up, and then crisis comes along and it dies away and people sort of fall into their old bad habits again. And that narrative essentially sticks all the way up to about 9/11, when you find people within the White House, within the FBI, within the CIA, all these different pockets kind of alerted to the threat of al-Qaeda, but they don't know how to find each other. They can't reach out to one another. There are legal barriers to prevent them from sharing. There are cultural barriers. And it's just striking to me how that lesson from Beirut was really never absorbed, even though there were people in the government at the time of 9/11 who were in the government when Beirut happened and remembered exactly why it occurred and what the failures were. Mm.
Well, just to come up again real quick to the post-9/11 period, when, again, so this is something that had been a long interest of John Poindexter's.
Right.
And so now the need comes again, the same problems are there. He comes forward again with this proposition that's what we can do is, what he would argue we can do, is come up with a way to collect vast amounts of data and then go through that and look for some useful information. At the same time, that we subsequently learned that, in fact, the government was really doing that in secret. That is, the White House had authorized the NSA to do wiretaps without court orders. That story just exploded on the front page of the New York Times. And so we found out that, yes, in fact, the government was doing it and that they were doing it in secret. So those people who were involved in that effort, what did they think of Poindexter and his more public argument that we could construct an agency to do this and here's how we would do it and that we did in fact need to do it?
Yeah, they were very leery of him for a number of reasons. One being that Poindexter's effort was so public. It was important to emphasize that Total Information Awareness at the time was a research program. It was not actually out collecting intelligence. It was more, what's the realm of the possible? What could we do? And behind the scenes, of course, over at National Security Agency, they're doing a lot of what Poindexter wanted to do. So they were very cautious of that, the fact that he was public. They were very cautious of his political baggage and how he could be, you know, anything that was associated with Poindexter immediately sort of becomes tainted. But there's also this sort of tradition at the National Security Agency, this kind of, you know, if I might say, very insular kind of way of thinking. There's a phrase that's all often used of not invented here. And it's the idea that if we, the agency, with all of our resources, and we're the experts in surveillance and collecting digital communications and analysis, if we did invent it here, it must not be very good because we have all the best people. So I think there was a real reluctance on the part of NSA to trust anybody who had another idea of how to do this project to go out and collect huge amounts of information and connect the dots. And, of course, the final aspect of this is why I think they were so reluctant to talk to anybody is because potentially what they were doing was illegal. Mm-hmm. They knew that they were operating on fairly thin legal ground, that this was a secret program that had personally been authorized by the president. It was kept in the highest secrecy. And then ultimately when conflicts arose within the administration over the legality of the program, there was even more effort put in to try and keep it more secret than it was. So, you know, I think that people at NSA probably looked at Poindexter with some amount of admiration for his technological skills and for his ambition, but ultimately I think wanted nothing to do with him and nothing to do with anything that was that public at the time.
And it seems that eventually the whole project just kind of faded away.
It did. It's an interesting sort of twist. What happens is Poindexter, ultimately, as there's more media attention drawn to what he's doing, and of course his political baggage gets brought up again, the pressure on him just becomes too great, and he resigns. And Congress, when they sort of figure out more about what Total Information Awareness is, and it becomes more and more associated with this sort of big brother kind of idea of really threatening technology, Congress decides that they should pull the plug on the funding. But as I write in the book, there's sort of an 11th hour effort behind the scenes with people from Poindexter's office and with people on some of the congressional committees with oversight for funding for these issues to try and save a lot of his programs. And so, curiously, while he was running this very public program that was not classified, you could go on a website, read information about it, a deal is struck at the last minute to pull all of the programs out of DARPA, where they were, as public programs, to change their code names and to put them into the classified intelligence budget. In other words, to take them out of the realm of the public and put them into a secret funding area where they could be funded secretly and they would be handled as classified programs. And ironically, the agency that inherited them is, in fact, the National Security Agency, which was doing all this work in secret anyway. And at the time, Poindexter and others did not know about it because the story hadn't broken. So on the surface, while total information awareness seemed to fade away, actually, it went behind a secret curtain absorbed by the very people who were doing this work in the first place.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Shane Harris. He writes about electronic surveillance, intelligence, counterterrorism for the National Journal in Washington, D.C. His new book is The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. It's just now out in paper from Penguin. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Thomasboro, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, David. It's Doug. Hi.
Hi, Doug.
You know, as I listened to all this thing, you know, I've been totally involved in implementing and putting together all of the Department of Defense and military response programs for this intel, and the not invented here thing that he talked about is very, very real. But one of the problems we ran into, and again, we've shared information discussed on this, is the intelligence stuff and the counterterrorism is pretty much turned into what I call frightening the public type thing. Because, again, during 9-1-1, at that time, again, black operations, not Al-Qaeda, anything, we had to implement all the battle plans we had in place. The warnings, even on that day from the United Nations, and you've got a copy of it, were out there, and we knew what was going to happen. But, again, because of the whole thing and trying to pin this on Al-Qaeda and everybody else in order for us to launch the battle plans we had in place, we had a lot of problems with all this stuff, and we're seeing the same thing today. So I guess the question I have for the guest is, given all this stuff, knowing what we do know happened in the intelligence community, how do we get all the gods that be to be honest about the intelligence they have and not use the intelligence they have or misuse the intelligence they have to implement all of the invasion, the battle plans that we have had in place for a long time?
Well, I think if the question is, you know, how do we sort of fix this problem, right? I mean, so it doesn't repeat again. I mean, I think this is something that ultimately I think requires presidential attention. And the Bush administration, you know, the answer to this was, let's create a director of national intelligence, let's create a new counterterrorism center, let's kind of put everybody together, get them all playing on the same team. And 9/11 did kind of, as a shock to the system, get a lot of these different agencies to start cooperating better. The problem that they have now, and I write about this at the end of the book, is that the information that the counterterrorism community, if I can sort of widely call it that, is that it's collecting, is overwhelming them. They're collecting so much information on emails, phone calls, travel patterns. They're trying to effectively watch everything that's happening all around the world that has an electronic footprint. It's very difficult still to find that signal in the noise, to find that one kind of the needle in the haystack, if I can use that analogy. And I think the way that you ultimately do that is by making some very hard decisions about how much you're going to invest, A, in technology to detect this stuff, but B, about possibly even not trying to sort of pay attention to all of it, of just trying to focus on the potential leads, the stuff that might actually bear fruit, rather than the approach right now, which is to kind of try and look at everything and gather all of it. That's very hard to do, I think, politically, because if there is another event, another attack, nobody wants to say, well, it was my decision to stop looking at, you know, this kind of record, and that ultimately was where the smoking gun was that was going to tip us off to the next attack. So there's sort of this sense, I think it's very frantic right now, if we have to collect all this information and try to keep up with it as best we can, because we don't want to leave any stone unturned. And as Al-Qaeda has proven, they're very resilient. They adapt their strategies. It can be extraordinarily difficult to know where they're going to strike next or how. And I think that, you know, the counterterrorism community has done an admirable job, but I think it's just sort of treading water on a lot of this stuff right now. And I don't think, frankly, that it's gotten enough attention from senior policymakers in the government who really need to step in at this point and sort of reassess what is the effort and how are we doing and why are we failing when we fail.
Yeah, I come back to the same thing, though, what you talked about, Bush. Actually, all those programs we put together were put together on Clinton, Gore, and Reno, and they were presidential decision directors, 39-62. And, I mean, the Al-Qaeda threat is virtually a non-threat. I mean, we've used that as a justification for what we're doing. And I have to come back to 9-1-1 again. based on all the solid evidence we have, the involved with the stuff, the people, the claims of 9-1-1 are not happened. No aircraft hit the Pentagon, and actually explosive brought down the World Trade Center. So, I mean, these are actual things that we do know from solid evidence from the people who were involved and those of us who were involved in cleaning up the messes or whatever. So, again, it's how we use the intelligence, I think, that we gather. It's also critical. You have to use it, and you have to use it with validity and tell the truth, and you can't misuse it, as we have done now for years and years and years, to justify our illegal interventions.
Well,
anyhow,
let's get
some thoughts.
Let me. Yeah, I don't know if there's any. I have another caller here. I don't know if there's anything else you want to comment on having to do with what the caller says.
No, I mean, I think we disagree on what actually happened on 9/11, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, just again, I think you've made the point, but I think to underscore the point here, it seems that what you were saying, and I think what a lot of people involved in this effort are arguing, is that the problem here is not, it's not collecting information.
Right.
The problem is we have so much, the sheer volume of information is so much that it's almost useless, because there's really no way to sort through it all to pick out the few small details in among all of this information that's essentially useless. It pretty much makes the whole thing useless.
That's right. I mean, and to the caller's point, too, there's also there is the risk of misuse of intelligence. I mean, I think that many people would agree, I think this has been quite well documented, that intelligence in the lead-up to the war in Iraq was cast through a particular lens that was trying to lead towards a particular conclusion. So you know, there's always the threat, absolutely, that information can be misused, that it can be slanted. But, I mean, I think to your point just that you made just now, that's a pretty good statement of where we are, I think the intelligence community is really inundated with information, and it's very hard to just sort of take that whole bucket and say, okay, where do we start? It's not to say that there are not investigations that are going on and leads that can be followed. Of course there are. But when you're talking about threats that just sort of come out of the blue, how do you predict that? How do you find that meaningful signal in that noise? That's something that Poindexter was trying to do and people are still struggling with. It's probably the hardest intelligence problem that there is.
All right. Line 2, Champaign County. Hello.
Yeah, I don't want to get diverted in this, but I've talked to Doug before, and the explosive residues that were in the air afterwards came from the demolition of the building that fell down later, and that's been admitted to on a Frontline show, so it's not still widely spoken of. It was an insurance fraud, basically, so I don't buy that scenario either, but I think that it is being used to do the things that he was suggesting. So, but I... I find it a little hard to deal with you're starting with Beirut. Beirut is not that was a military operation, aka peacekeeping group, in a what was tantamount to a war zone during the Civil War of Lebanon. I don't see how that has much to do with a policy analysis about what should be done inside the U.S. Now, we know that Cheney was de-anonymizing NSA intercepts prior to 9/11, so we knew where they were wanting to go. So, but I just would like to hear something more concrete about what's going on the ground. I mean, one thing you haven't mentioned is the privatization of intelligence. TIA went into groups like SAIC, Special Agent in Charge, CIA backwards. We have a big presence on college campuses, a $9 billion intelligence chain, SecDef. We'll probably go back to that. But anyway, but also some specifics on, are you following what's both called fusion centers and synchronization centers around the country? The head of the California group was forced to resign because it was pretty clear the military were using these nominally civilian outfits to do surveillance on all sorts of Quakers. And I mean, there's an astonishing story here that I haven't heard much about on the ground. But I would like for you to start with why the heck Beirut has much to do with downtown Belleville, Illinois, or whatever you
want. Sure. Well, a couple things. First, Beirut was really the first instance of suicidal religious terrorism, or Islamic terrorism, if you want to call it that, against the United States. And it really touches off as I'm sure you remember very well, I mean, a series of, you know, there are bombings, there are hijackings throughout the 1980s. There's the Achille Lauro incident, which I write about in the book. But this was really sort of the first kind of explosive right there attack that the national security apparatus had seen. Absolutely true. It's a war zone. It's an attack on a military target. But the intelligence problem behind it is analogous to 9/11. Yes, 9/11 happening on U.S. soil and the aftermath and the response being domestic operations, that changes a lot, surely from a policy and a legal framework. But the essential intelligence problem of we were collecting information about threats against U.S. interests and no one was putting them together, that remains the same. To your point about the privatization of intelligence, which is something you know I've written about and others have as well, that was in fact a very big part of total information awareness. I mean, the model behind TIA was not just, oh, let's, you know, get all of the government actors on the same page here. It was, let's go out to the private sector where a lot of the best expertise and technology lies and get them involved as well. So there were a number of companies you know, in the Washington area that did get contracts, that were working on this. And this is, you know, this is something that I think is absolutely the way things are done today. I mean, it would be disingenuous to suggest that the government is not being assisted by contractors in doing counterterrorism and intelligence analysis. In fact, I think there are some agencies where probably the contractors outnumber the number of government employees. You really have had this kind of fusion of both sides of government and industry, and in many ways it's become somewhat indistinguishable. Fusion centers are another good example of that. I mean, these are, for your listeners who don't know, after 9/11 there was an effort to set up sort of miniature kind of information sharing operations in various states and cities all over the country with an eye towards getting not just the federal side coordinating with each other more and playing along well, but to get them cooperating with state, local governments, and also with the private sector. And I've written about those as well. And, you know, for all of, I think, the good intentions behind centers like that, to try and be sort of eyes and ears on the ground in a local community at the state level for threats, there's been well-documented cases now of these centers implicating people that are not actually involved in any kind of criminal activity or, frankly, just getting some of the information wrong. I mean, there's the most recent example is not long after the shooting in Tucson when Representative Giffords and the others were shot and those folks were killed there, allegedly by Jared Loftner. There was a report put together by a fusion center in Arizona trying to link Loftner to a what was billed as a nationalist white supremacist group. It turned out that the links were not there, the characterization of the group was not accurate, but that information was leaked to the press. And very quickly after the shooting, it was then passed off as an official Homeland Security Department memo linking this shooter to some sort of right-wing militia group. Total exaggeration, stretch, I mean, you know, just a distortion of what was actually happening on the ground in a very confusing time. And that was the product we've found out now, if there's been a subsequent reporting on this, of a few employees at a fusion center kicking around ideas, putting something in a memo, and probably leaking it out to the press. So you see how, I mean, in this kind of, you know, proliferation of all these different intelligence centers in the wake of 9/11, there are some of them, I think, that are just really at risk of getting it wrong with really potentially damaging consequences. Because I think in the wake of that shooting, when things were so confused, the last thing that anybody needed was more bad information out there in the public confusing people about what really happened.
Well, how much do you spend time surveying what I brought up, which is the anti-war groups being surveyed?
There was a lot of activity out at there was a group in the Pentagon called the Counterintelligence Field Activity, or CIFA, that was set up after 9/11. And it was documented, in fact, that they had been gathering information about people who were protesting at military sites, that there had been reports done up on Quakers, on others, even pacifist groups. You know, part of the problem in documenting and researching this and why it's often frustrating for reporters is that so much of this is actually secret and so much of this is hidden behind closed doors. But when these events, you know, are exposed and they come out, I think what it shows is that there was absolutely a pattern after 9/11 of extensive surveillance of groups inside the United States. I mean, good luck proving that in court, and many of them have tried, and sued unsuccessfully to get records, a lot of groups, to find out whether, for instance, they were the targets of warrantless wiretapping. But I think that the evidence certainly points to a tremendous expansion of domestic surveillance. And, you know, my book takes a piece of it, and others have as well.
I'm going to jump in here and reintroduce our guest. We're coming into our last 15 minutes or so in this hour of focus, and I'd like you to know that if you just joined us, our guest is Shane Harris. He writes about electronic surveillance, intelligence, counterterrorism for the National Journal in Washington, D.C., and is the author of book, The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. It's published by the Penguin Press, just came out in hardcover last year, and now, within the last few weeks, is out in paperback. It's published by Penguin, so if you'd like to read it, the book's available. Questions, welcome to 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to go back, I realize we're jumping around a little bit in time, but just to go back, after the Beirut attack, and then after some of the attacks involving al-Qaeda, but before 9/11, there were people in Washington that were very concerned about trying to get some assessment of this threat, and that we're doing this kind of thing that we're talking about. And in fact, there was something developed called Able Danger. What was Able Danger?
Sure. I should just correct you, by the way. I write for Washingtonian Magazine now, no longer National Journal. It's a recent switch. That's okay.
My apologies. Well, I'm...
No problem. I was at National Journal for many years. So
I confess I'm reading off the dust jacket of the a hardcover edition
okay.
of the book.
No, that's no problem.
All right.
Just don't want to make my old bosses and my new bosses upset. Able Danger, you're right, it's a fascinating chapter in the pre-9/11 history. Basically, how this begins is it's a program that's run by the military. In the late 90s into the early 2000s, the Special Operations Command of the military decided that they needed to understand what al-Qaeda was and where its members were. Remember, this is in the wake of the embassy bombings in Africa in the late 90s. And the military decides that, you know, that this is potentially a mission that it can take on to find out what is al-Qaeda, where is it, and how can we roll up this network? In other words, target it, eliminate members, set up defenses, whatever, kind of almost, you know, go to war with al-Qaeda in a covert way. And they set up a program called Able Danger, which was an effort to essentially lay out a campaign plan of how they could go to war against al-Qaeda overseas. And ultimately, they were frustrated in the early stages of this because they found that there wasn't a lot of great information within the government about how to actually target al-Qaeda. There was knowledge of al-Qaeda's sort of roots within the CIA, certainly not a lot of knowledge about its presence and where it might be operating, but from the military standpoint, they wanted something more tactical from their view, and they felt that they weren't getting it from the intelligence community. So they started up a program to actually use technology. At the time, very innovative technology. You and I would look at it today and call it Google. To basically go out through government databases, but also on the internet and using keyword searches, try and bring back information that was related to al-Qaeda and its potential, the extent of its network. And at the time, this was a very innovative approach because you're talking about going out and mixing this publicly available, what people in the government call open source information that anyone can access because it's on a web page, it's in a chat room, and then trying to bring it back and fuse it with the secret intelligence that you're gathering and to try and create a fuller picture. Again, this effort to connect the dots, to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And I think they had some degree of success in the early stages of the Able Danger program, and I interviewed members of that pretty extensively. They believed that they had identified not only a global network of al-Qaeda, but they had found cells or potentially members and contacts of al-Qaeda inside the United States. And this was obviously very alarming to them. Unfortunately, the program was shut down before there was any chance to investigate these leads further, because once lawyers in the Pentagon realized that in the course of gathering all of these leads and going out and doing things like internet searches, that the Able Danger team was pulling back in the names of U.S. citizens and individuals who might innocuously appear or just randomly appear on some of these web pages, that they were going out and mining, and that these names were being back and being pulled back and put into intelligence databases. And while the aim of the program was obviously not to spy on people inside the United States, those names were sort of gathered up in what they called the data harvest and were sort of lumped in with all of the other potential bad actors that they were looking at. And as the military saw that, this was a clear violation of privacy laws, that you cannot allow intelligence agencies pre-9/11 to go out and start doing searches on people inside the United States, that those kinds of activities have to be overseen by courts. They're very sensitive. And what it looked like to military lawyers was that a domestic spying operation was being set up at a military intelligence agency. So you can only imagine what the political implications of that would have been had it become public. So Able Danger was shut down, and it really wasn't until after the 9/11 Commission report was issued and 3 years after the attacks that any of this ever came to light, when finally some of the members of the team started to step forward to say that they felt that they were doing good work and potentially had identified some of the actors in the 9/11 attacks. And it's at that point when the rest of the world became aware that there was even this program working in the months before 9/11 that at the time very few people knew about. Hmm.
I want to just for a moment to go back to, we talked a little bit earlier about the basic problem here being that it's possible that for the government to collect so much data that it's almost useless. This project of mining this data because there's so much data is so difficult because you're maybe looking for, it's the proverbial needle in the haystack. You know, to find the needles, it's almost impossible. Now, having said that, though, you wonder, you know, we got a lot of smart people in this country. We've got a lot of computing power. One of the things I think you write about is the fact that after the dot-com bubble burst, there were a lot of people in the high-tech field who were looking for work and looking for customers and turned to the government. You would have to think that there would be enough power here, brain and computing power, to actually crack this problem. Does anybody think that it's actually a solvable problem?
There are. I mean, John Poindexter is still one of them, and now that he's left government, he is actually working in private sector with the company to try and do this. It's obviously it's a very labor-intensive kind of process, but I within the government, we get back to this same problem of, again, the not invented here, and each agency sort of wants to take its own approach. I think there are people who believe that this problem is solvable. What I don't see in Washington right now is a concerted effort to really fund new, innovative, cutting-edge technologies that might actually be able to do this kind of analysis. And I think the reason for that is largely the fear of the politics that are associated with it. I mean, if you say, you know, we're going to throw $1 billion at new sophisticated data mining technology, people obviously get very suspicious about that. I get very suspicious about that. It's my job as a reporter. I don't think that the energy is really there right now to sort of do the Manhattan Project for counterterrorism that John Poindexter wanted to do. And it doesn't surprise me that the energy is not there, because this is the pattern with these attacks, is that something big and terrible happens. There's a lot of initial energy to try to fix the problem, and for one reason or another, the energy dissipates and the pattern starts to take hold again. In fact, we saw it repeat on with the December 25th, the Christmas Day bombing a few years ago with a young man who tried to hide a bomb inside of his underwear and blow up the airliner over Detroit. Had that event been successful, I would be sitting here talking to you now about how you went from Beirut to 9/11 to this, and that the causes were exactly the same and that the pattern repeated itself. The breakdown in information sharing and an analysis, the failure to connect the dots before that Christmas Day attack, which thankfully was not successful, is very much like what happened before 9/11, what happened before Beirut. So the bureaucracy tends to take over, and I think in a lot of ways smother the kind of innovation that people like John Poindexter and others were pushing for. It doesn't, you know, it sounds crazy that the government would not put all of its resources behind this problem, but there are just a lot of other vested interests that are probably too much to go into in our conversation now, but that just have a way of ultimately conspiring to keep really great ideas and great energy from rising to the top. It's very rare that it ever happens in large organizations, particularly in government.
Mm. Well, we're now coming up to the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, and I think that there are some people who would make the argument that the fact that nothing of that scale has happened since says that the changes that we have made in our intelligence and counterterrorism structure in this country have been successful, And the fact that there's been nothing like 9/11 since demonstrates that. I think there are other people who would say the fact that there has been nothing like that since is sheer luck. And that it's almost a certainty that given enough time, there's going to be something else of that level. So being someone who spent a lot of time writing about this, which of those things do you think is more true?
Probably the latter. I mean, it is true that, you know, in the nearly 10 years since 9/11 now, we have not seen an event on that scale. But it's also true that we have almost seen events on that scale. And I'll give you three examples. All of these were plots that were ultimately thwarted or sort of fizzled out. But in 2005, there was the plot to smuggle liquid bombs onto transatlantic airliners, which had it been successful, probably would have killed more people than died on 9/11. That plot was ultimately foiled at the last minute, and is the reason why we now have to put all of our liquids in small plastic bags before we take them on the airplane. There was the Christmas Day bomb that I mentioned as well. There have been these incidents that we really just sort of get it at the last minute, or we get intelligence or a lead that helps us to prevent it, or they just fizzle out. They don't sort of they don't come to fruition. That is partly luck. There's some skill involved in that from the intelligence community as well. But I think it would be foolish for anyone to say, well, because there hasn't been a 9/11 style event since 9/11, the problem must have dissipated. In fact, I think that Al-Qaeda has evolved. There was an initial response, obviously, to the 9/11 attacks that involved us going into Afghanistan, that involved military campaigns, that involved aggressive intelligence operations. And I think that that may have put Al-Qaeda back on its heels. But it has demonstrated since then that it's remarkably resilient, and it is looking for new ways to penetrate our defenses and is having some success with that. So I think that we're sort of looking at the next evolution of Al-Qaeda now, and it's probably only a matter of time before something on the order of 9/11 happens. And again, those examples that I mentioned are ones that, had they occurred, you would have been talking about them as, you know, the next 9/11, as finally they got us again. The conversation would have changed had they been successful.
Yeah. Well, just as a way of finishing up, I think the point you make and the way you've already touched on it is that the kind of conversation that we're having now is something we should be having as a nation, talking about what we should be doing and talking about how it is we balance the need for security with the need for privacy and civil liberties. And that it's a conversation we ought to be having, because your argument is that if we do have another big event, something like 9/11, then at that point, all of the concerns about individual civil liberties, they're just going to be swept right off the table. So how do we have a conversation like that, given that people's minds are on so many other things? And, you know, the further and further we get away from 9/11, I suppose that the more and more people will say, well, we don't really need to worry about that.
Right. I think that it's a great question. And I do think that we have to make these decisions now and not in the breach or in the moment of crisis, because history shows us we tend to make pretty bad decisions, or not very long, when the ones that don't last for very long. There are some points where things that I could look to just have some hope. I mean, there is right now, there is an effort. It's not completely related to physical terrorism, but related to sort of an offshoot of this, related to cybersecurity and internet security. There is legislation now before Congress that's being hotly debated over what authorities the government should have when it comes to policing the internet, what authority should the president have to be able to step in a moment of national crisis. That's a good debate to be having. There are avenues for that legislatively here in Washington, through various groups coming together to try and hammer out those details. That's what I would really like to see, and what I advocate more for in the book, is the different stakeholders in this coming together to try and fashion rules and laws that make sense, and that are the product of a sensible debate on these issues. We were unable to have that in large measure during the Bush administration because so much of this was kept secret, so much of the information was kept from Congress. So really, we're just getting to the point now where I think a lot of this is getting laid on the table and people can make sense of it. And these debates are going to start happening now. You know, the Patriot Act has been up for reauthorization. Every time that this happens, it provides another opportunity for these stakeholders to get together and to try and persuade each other what the right solution is. All that said, I mean, while that is happening, there is still this, you know, active war on terror that is going on, at which, you know, you find people in the intelligence community and the military on the front lines of this, and we still need to be very dedicated, I think, to supporting them with the resources and the tools that they need to do that job. And we can leave the policy and the lawmaking discussion to the people who do that. But these frontline operators ultimately need to be supported. And my fear is that, and again, these other instances like the Christmas Day bombing and some of these other events, what you see is that these people are really just sort of struggling to keep their head above water. It's a tremendously difficult job, and I'm not sure that they are being actively supported in the way that they need to be. And that's something that is that kind of support really can only come from the president. It has to come from the top down.
Yeah. Just to go back to something we also touched on a little bit earlier, one of the problems that was pointed to after 9/11, and everybody seemed to recognize it, is that we had a number of different government agencies, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the Pentagon, that all had access to a lot of different kinds of information. But the problem was they weren't talking with each other. There were intense turf battles. They weren't sharing information. Nobody was in a position to take the best bits and put them together and make a complete sort of picture. So what was one of the things that was done was to essentially to create a new position that would be an umbrella that would encompass all of this, all of these various pieces in the intelligence community, and someone who would become an advisor to the president. So this was this new director of national intelligence. Has that made much difference? Has that gotten at that problem of agencies not talking to each other?
I don't think it has solved the problem that the position was created to solve, which was to not just to get everyone sort of playing nice together, but to actively manage all of these different agencies in the intelligence community. And the primary reason for that, and this is something that previous directors have brought up, is that the DNI, that position today, still does not have budgetary authority. And in Washington, whoever controls the money has the power. Whoever controls the resources has the power. That position still does not have authority over most of the spending that goes on in the intelligence community today. The official who has that control is the Secretary of Defense. Most of the intelligence budget is, in fact, in the military side. And so the Secretary of Defense has a lot of that influence. And previous directors have said that until you vest real budgetary teeth with that Director of National Intelligence position, he or she is never going to be able to fully realize the mandate that position was given when the law was set up several years ago. And it's unfortunate because now what you have is a position that is the success or the failure entirely depends on the personality of the person who is in it. So, you know, they have to decide which battles they're going to pick and, you know, whether they're going to have a high profile or a low one. And it's not automatically just presumed when that person comes in, yes, you're in charge. And we see for different examples of these, again, intelligence turf battles coming up again, where the CIA is trying to assert itself, the FBI is asserting itself, everyone is sort of grabbing their own levers here. And it's, again, very analogous to what happened before 9/11 when people were not operating well together. The only way you fix that problem is by changing the law that governs the DNI position, and I think giving that person real authority. And I think if policymakers and legislators decide that that's not something that they want to do, then they need to take responsibility for that and effectively say, look, we tried it. We tried to create this position. It didn't work. We're going to move on and do something else.
Our guest, Shane Harris, has been writing about intelligence, national security for a decade now. He's senior writer at Washingtonian Magazine, former staff correspondent for the National Journal. And his book, if you'd like to read it, is The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. It is now available in paperback, published by Penguin. And Mr. Harris, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting New Worlds on Saturday, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Korean violinist and protege of Itzhak Perlman, Han Bin, joins the symphony for two virtuosic pieces.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Both corn and wheat have turned to the positive side, while over in soybeans, it is very much a bear spreading affair with the nearbys lower and a few of the deferreds higher. Let's look at some of the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat is trading at 843.5, up 13.5. July is 854, up 13.5. September, 865.75, up 9.75. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 734.25, up 20. July, 769.5, up 19.25. September, 806.5, up 17.5. May corn, 684.75, up 3.75. July, 691.25, up 2.75. September, 649.5, up 4. December, 614.5, up 4.75. March of 2012 is at 621.75, up 3.75. May crude oil's at 105.87. It's up